I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people who are the traditional owners of this land. I would also like to pay respect to the elders, both past and present, of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians present. My name is Professor Helen Sullivan. I'm the director of the Centre for Public Policy, which is in the School of Social and Political Sciences, and I'm the moderator of tonight's debate. And it's with great pleasure that I welcome you to this, the second in a series of Q&A panel discussions that explores a topical issue relating to the teaching programmes in the Graduate School of Humanities and Social Sciences here at the University of Melbourne. And tonight we're focusing on public policy and management. We're also very grateful to crikey.com.au for helping us and supporting us with this event this evening. The panel will be recorded, I need to tell you, and available on the web soon after the event. Please leave your mobile phone on, but on silent. We are going to encourage everyone to tweet questions to the panel during the discussion. There might be some limited reception. I know some people have experienced limited reception in this theatre. So staff and students with uni wireless access, please feel free to submit. Others of you, there will of course be an opportunity to ask questions in the old-fashioned way. We have microphones available for you to ask questions in person. And I hope that you can all join us at the reception in the Arts Hall, which will follow immediately after this debate to meet with the students and the panellists and further the discussion. So if politics is the art of the possible, then public policy might be said to be the product of that possibility, the painting, the sculpture, or the installation, depending on your artistic preference, that represents the outcome of the political process. And the debate tonight focuses on what happens to the quality of politics and policy art in periods of minority administration, and asks particularly how vulnerable groups fare in circumstances like this. And this is a live issue in Australia and also in other countries like the UK, which is unused to hung parliaments at a national level. Here, Prime Minister Gillard must balance her policy priorities with those of the interests of crossbench parliamentarians on whom she depends. Now, does this mean that she's more focused on her political vulnerability than on the concerns of society's vulnerable? So that's the focus of our discussion this evening, and we have an eminently qualified panel to debate these issues, and I just want to take a moment to introduce them to you. On my right, we have Mr. Tim Wilson, who is an international public policy analyst and commentator, specialising in international trade, health, intellectual property and climate change policy. Tim, for those who don't know, is the Director of Climate Change Policy and the Intellectual Property and Free Trade Unit at the Institute of Public Affairs, the world's oldest free market think tank.
Correct.
We've done our research. Then I'd like to introduce Mr. Adam Bant, MP. Greens MP Adam Bant is an industrial lawyer and barrister and the federal member for Melbourne. Adam is the first Greens MP elected to the House of Representatives at a federal election. Welcome, Adam. Dr. Margaret Simons, immediately on my left, is an award-winning freelance journalist and author of 7 books and numerous essays and articles. Margaret is convener of journalism at Swinburne University of Technology and chair of the Public Interest Journalism Foundation. Margaret blogs on journalism and the media at The Content Makers and is a media commentator for the internet-based news service crikey.com. Dr. Narelle Miragliotta is a lecturer in Australian politics at Monash University. She's published and specialises in green politics, in the role of political parties, and the role of the media. And next to her is Dr. Scott Brenton, who's a lecturer here at the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He's also the coordinator of the Master's Programme in Public Policy and Public Management, and is a previous parliamentary fellow. So I'd like you all to welcome the panel this evening, and I think you can see from the range of places they come from, we're hoping and likely to have a very lively debate. The way this is going to work is that we've been asking via the Twitter feed for questions to be sent to us via the web. So we're going to start with some pre-arranged questions that have already come in. Then I'm going to open it up to the debate. And as I say, at any time you can tweet questions or there'll be microphones available for you to ask questions. So away we go. The first question then. The Queen, as some of you may know, is on a limited stop tour to Australia at the moment. During her stay, she will visit flood victims in Queensland, but not visit Indigenous communities in the Northern Territories. What message do you think this sends, if any, about the political prioritisation of vulnerable groups? And I'd like to start with Adam for that question.
I think it's
I'm probably the last person in the world that you'd expect to be a defender of the Queen. I don't know that particularly focusing on her itinerary is the real point, but I think that I think it would be clearly, obviously, better if greater attention was paid to the state of Indigenous health in this country. And I think it would be great if the Queen went and visited some Indigenous communities. The fact that she's not going, I don't know, says an enormous amount. It says more about the monarchy than it does about the state of political priorities in Australia, I would think.
Yeah. Okay. Tim, what's your reaction?
Well, my reaction is that ordinarily in these things, I'm sure the palace would take advice from the government on these things, and I suspect it actually says more about the government than says anything about the monarchy or the Queen. And, you know, there's a real question about how much this Indigenous disadvantage has actually been an issue that has been focused in this parliament, considering I would have thought it would be at the forefront of the political cycle's mind, obviously with the role of Adam in the parliament. But also I think that, you know, it's one of the areas of public policy where there's actually a general, and I say very general, bipartisan consensus, certainly about the problem, let alone, in fact, it's multi-party consensus about the problem. And then we get into obviously what the solution is and we get to more divergent opinions. And obviously saw, when was it, earlier this week when Tony Abbott was up in Cape York. And so I think it says more about how much emphasis is being put in the parliament than has anything to do with the government. And in terms of the priorities, I think it just shows that it isn't a priority at the moment. And I think that's a sad thing.
Okay, Margaret.
Well, I think the Queen these days is the ultimate public relations operative, really. And so I agree it reflects the priorities of the government, but it also reflects what the Australian government wants to draw attention to overseas, given that she will be accompanied by the media pack. And so that's really all there is to say about it. They would prefer to draw attention to the efforts of overcoming the effects of the floods than to Indigenous Australia. Nothing new about that, sadly. And I don't think it's anything to do with minority government. I think it reflects the priorities of governments over decades, if not centuries.
So there's nothing particular about this that we should...
I wouldn't have thought so, no.
OK. Narelle, what's your...
No, I think I would have to agree with Margaret on that. I'm not entirely certain that it says anything in particular. I think these are issues that are already fairly sensitive anyway, and I think you run the risk of increasing the politicisation of those... although these are clearly issues that probably should be and must be, but I'm not entirely certain that it necessarily generates the kinds of outcomes that people might want.
OK. And Scott?
Okay, well, seeing as everyone's being really sort of civil, I'll be a little bit controversial. I think it says a lot. I think it says, well, particularly given that the Queen's at a reception this evening with Geoffrey Gurumul Yunupingu performing, you know, why isn't she visiting Indigenous communities? You know, why it seems that we're comfortable with appropriating parts of Indigenous culture and show the nice parts of Indigenous culture, but not acknowledging the realities of it. Also with you mentioned the Queensland floods, and again, when there's a disaster affecting citizens in marginal seats, there's a big government response to that. But when there's an ongoing issue of severe disadvantage, there doesn't seem to be that same urgency. But to be fair to the Queen, I mean, Gillard herself is rarely seen in Indigenous communities, so I think it does also reflect the priorities of the government. It probably would be a bit galling, though, if the Queen did visit Indigenous communities in remote areas. You know, think of the protocol issues, people not wearing hats, people refusing to curtsy. So I think acting on good advice, it's just too controversial to do it, but it is an issue I think that needs more attention, and something like this could have focused some attention onto it.
I think it's expecting probably more than could be reasonably expected of the monarchy to expect it to be the lightning rod that draws attention to social disadvantage in Australia and fixes it. That's not what the monarchy's about, with respect.
But except that given, and this, you know, extraordinary for me as a recently arrived British person, you know, the coverage, the amount of media coverage that the Queen's visit has garnered, you know, in a way, it's almost an ideal opportunity to focus attention on that as an issue.
Sure, but that's not what the monarchy's about.
I don't think we've seen much, though, I might be wrong on this, but I haven't seen much coverage from the Governor-General, her representative, you know, basically throughout the time of this parliament, or even in the last parliament, actually focusing much on Indigenous disadvantaged visiting communities either. So I just see it as part of a consistent trend, actually. There's nothing particularly surprising about it. And again, it comes back to government priorities. It's low. Okay.
Margaret, you wanted to come back?
Well, I was just going to say I've no idea what the thinking is, and I suspect it is just a lack of priorities, but you also have to think about the entourage that goes around with the Queen, the media pack, the and everything else that goes around with her, and there would actually be logistical issues as well, I think, behind getting that many people out to remote Australia and Indigenous communities for any length of time, which would in some ways perhaps be a burden, I'm guessing. I don't know if that was part of the thinking or not, quite probably not, but it would be difficult.
Okay, so the consensus on the panel, with the notable exception of Scott, who's doing his best to stir things up, is that this isn't a meaningful issue. This is something that just reflects the consistency of Indigenous communities being a low priority in government.
I think we didn't say it's not a meaningful issue, but I think we all agree it is a meaningful issue. It's just about political priorities.
Is that the view of the audience, that this simply mirrors the fact that this is a low priority for government? How many people in the audience think that this just reflects the fact of the low priority of the policy issue? Okay. How many people disagree? Think there's something else going on? Okay. Well, the panel's at one with the audience, it seems. We might come back to this in the discussion. Okay. As I said, the issue of the focus of the panel is really to think about the nature and the quality of politics and policy in a minority administration. And I think we'll want to focus specifically on that in the next question, which is to ask, to what extent is it more or less difficult to protect the interests of vulnerable groups in a period of minority government? And Tim, can I start with you on that one?
Define vulnerable groups. Minority parliaments can throw up any number of combinations, and based on that, you can get a numerous number of outcomes. Nature of the minority government we have at the moment is we have a Labor Party that's heavily divided between left and right factions. We have obviously Adam in part of that sort of broad coalition, though not is it an official coalition? What's the official
no,
title?
Not a coalition.
No, what's the official
not,
title?
Not a coalition like the coalition.
No. But there's an agreement. And then you have obviously the other independents, and each of them come with their own political perspectives. But I think broadly what comes out of the coalition that exists is that it's not a question of what government should, whether government should do certain things, it's what government should do in certain things. And of course, as somebody who believes that the best interest of the community is represented when government is scarce and limited and people are free to pursue their own opportunities without government interference, what we're seeing is an increase in the size of government, surprisingly. As a result of this, it's just the nature and the package of how it's implemented. So what's the capacity to protect the interests of those disadvantaged? I think it's, from my perspective, quite narrow and quite limited. What we've seen is a series of legislation that's been passed that's going to add costs onto people's lives over time. Obviously, I'm talking about the carbon tax, but there are many others. And I don't think it's going to deliver a desirable outcome at all. And that, I think, is ultimately reflected in the polling results. And you're seeing that throughout the government. And that is a direct consequence of the minority status of the government, because there are a lot of issues, certainly in the way that they've been presented to the parliament and voted on in the relative speed that they have, that is predominantly a result of the minority status and the very successful influence of Mr. Bant and others.
Adam.
Where do I start? I think that, just think about the current parliament that we've got at the moment, and at the last election, I think it's fair to say that both of the old parties, Labor and the Coalition, lost. The biggest swing at the last election wasn't to the Coalition, it was to the Greens. And of course, Labor went backwards. And we now have this situation where there's a large number of people sitting on the crossbench. And I look at my colleagues that I've got sitting there next to me. I've got Andrew Wilkie, you've got Rob Oakeshott, Tony Windsor, Bob Catter, Tony Crook from the West Australian Nationals. And there's quite a broad range of backgrounds and political positions represented there. But I think it's interesting that we have this current political configuration, and I think it reflects the fact that across the board in cities and in rural areas, people are looking at the, amongst other things, it means that they're looking at the old parties and saying, well, in fact, you believe by and large the same thing on so many issues that matter to us, and those policies have in a lot of ways hurt us in our communities, and we now want different voices representing us. And that has meant a renewed attention on those areas, I think, of disadvantage, for example, especially in rural Australia. And so you now have a redressing of a lot of those imbalances with the rural independents saying we want more money for health in our areas. And as far as issues like asylum seekers go, I mean, talk about protecting vulnerable people, children who would have been expelled to Malaysia. If Melbourne was a Labor seat, the House of Representatives would have just passed a law allowing the government to expel children to Malaysia. And so I do think that in practical ways, as well as the principal politics of it all, it means a renewed attention on people who otherwise might not have been talked about.
Depends where you look. I think rural Australia, or large parts of rural Australia, can be defined as vulnerable people these days, and they're doing much better under this arrangement than they have done for decades. On the other hand, asylum seekers, we know, I believe, or the polls tell us, that the majority of Australians actually favour onshore processing. So why are both political parties so passionately against it? Presumably because there's just a few seats, marginal seats, where their internal research is telling them that those people don't want onshore processing. So that makes it more difficult. On the other hand, as Adam's just spelled out, if we didn't have a minority government, we would have had a very different outcome in the last few weeks. So it's really so broad, it depends where you look. There's some groups, such as Aboriginal Australia, which continue to miss out. I think we can conclude that the intervention hasn't worked as a generalisation. There are areas where it has, but as a broad generalisation, I think it hasn't worked. Where is the policy that's going to take us forward now? Has anybody got any ideas on this area? We're not hearing any of that in politics. But is that because of minority government? I don't think so. So, it depends where it looks. It's too broad a question really to answer sensibly.
But if it's not about minority government, what is it about then for you? The quality of policy being poor is not about minority government necessarily.
No, it isn't. I mean, the quality of policy development on both sides of politics has been atrocious for ages. it's not about minority government, particularly on the Labor side. I remember Cheryl Kernow, for example, complaining that they couldn't get any policy development going under Kim Beazley, and that wasn't a new problem then.
Why do you think that is? Because I share that view, and I have my own views, but why do you think it is?
Well, I think it's partly public opinion polling, which has led among the political class, and I include journalists among this, my own kind, to a focus on the sort of horse race of politics, the spectator sport of politics, who's up, who's down and why, rather than what's it actually about. And I think that's a general trend in society, and we could argue a lot about who's to blame for it. Lindsay Tanner blames the media. I think it's media and politicians and perhaps the public as well. But there's no doubt at all that if you compare the discussion in the media and in Parliament these days on issues of policy with, for example, during the time of Malcolm Fraser, which I just happen to have done a lot of research on, there's an enormous difference. People used to be addressed as though politics was something in which they actually had a stake and an interest. They were addressed as citizens. These days you hear endless journalism which addresses the voters as though it was talks about the voters as though they weren't in the room. and you feel like saying, well, hang on, don't talk about me like I'm not here. I'm a voter.
And does, Adam, I just want to push this, does having a different kind of administration, the fact that you do have an arrangement with Labour, does that in your view mean that in a sense you have to speak more meaningfully to citizens in order to get your issues across?
Yeah, and I think, so the arrangement that we reached with the government was to support them on supply and on confidence motions. Then there were a few policy agreements that we reached. So, for example, around climate change, getting money to dental care, high-speed rail, setting up a parliamentary budget office, which I think we should talk about tonight because I think that'll be one of the good public policy outcomes to come out of this time. But then apart from that, the agreement that we reached and all the other crossbenchers reached was that every piece of legislation, aside from all of those that I mentioned, was going to be judged on its merits. And what that has meant is that a political party can't just presume, well, we've got the numbers, so we're going to get this through regardless of whether it's a good idea or not. Every idea, every piece of legislation has to be the subject of discussion and collaboration. And that's been a fascinating process to have to get the Labor Party, the Greens and Country Independents all on the same page supporting something. And I think it's worked. And so I think you do, in fact, by having that focus on collaboration and things can't just get through because you've got the numbers, I think that improves the quality of debate and ultimately the output.
Tim, what's your...
I'm not really going to respond to Adam's thing because I don't disagree with some elements of it, but major parties have been hopeless at developing policy for a long time. I agree with Margaret. That has nothing to do with the minority nature of the government. It has to do partly with opinion polling, but it also has to do with the whole concept of how people view government and what's evolved. And, I blame a lot of this on John Howard, particularly in terms of how he restructured middle-class welfare to be about what people expect government to give them. Rather than what is the framework of a society that we should have.
That's right.
And as a consequence, everybody's always a winner or a loser in something, in some nature. I've been a loser a lot in this parliament and previous ones. There'll be plenty of other people in this room as a consequence. Now, I don't look at government that way, but when you get that and you have a constant constituency that can lose things, you're always shifting around who's going to lose in order to make sure you get you don't lose too much of a voter base. And that means we're really afraid of talking about big ideas, not just about the nature of government, but people might disagree with me, but the private sector in our society is fine. It needs tweaking, but it's basically fine in terms of its organisation. The big challenges and reforms we have over the next 30 years are in public sector reform, in how we make the basic principles of universal healthcare sustainable, in education as well, in age and disability support. All of these things are incredibly difficult to deal with and require policy maturity, which requires serious policy development. And I don't see any leadership, to be quite frank, out of this, even though we know the big warning bells coming out of the intergenerational report and everything else. And it's because there'll always be somebody who can lose. How can we have a society where basically for every person who's working by, 2.7 people, for every person who isn't working, there'll be 2.7 people supporting them. It's an unsustainable system in a lot of the ways we design our public policy on its current design. And I don't know how we're going to do it where you have people like myself who are never going to be entitled to a pension, who are paying superannuation and losing salary as a consequence into that. Meanwhile, I'm paying the pensions of somebody who reasonably expects, because they invested in the system their entire life, to continue receiving that. I'm double dipping. There's going to be this huge injustice, and this has always been an argument against the welfare state, between those who pay and those who don't. And I think, to be quite frank, the increase of the tax-free threshold is going to be an absolute disaster, because you are going to see more and more people paying for the system, not withdrawing, and more people not paying for a system, but still withdrawing from it. And we're going to have tension, as well as intergenerational tension, which appears in the private sector at the moment with relation to employment, et cetera.
Can I jump in there?
Yeah, cool.
My heart bleeds for Tim. Poor white middle-class male. I mean, you're a big loser in this policy sort of situation. I do want to pick up on some
points.
That
wasn't actually the point. The point was the concept of some people win, some people lose.
Sure.
And that's
but
true.
I think you need to take the totality of our society and not just, cherry-pick policies that don't happen to favour you. But the other point that I wanted to pick up...
That was precisely what I was arguing.
But the other point I wanted to pick up on was just your point about the private sector. I mean, have you heard of the global financial crisis?
I mean, yes,
there
I have.
Are problems with the private sector and with the banking sector.
What do you mean, injection of private, public financial instruments,
in response
basically?
In response to market failure. But I am glad you did acknowledge...
We can debate that.
Yeah,
I'll let you say what
I'm glad you acknowledged, though, that under the Howard government, government increased. I mean, they came in, they slashed a lot of expenditure, they slashed a lot of public servants. By the end of their term, the government was bigger than it has ever been before, and it really was an acknowledgement that governments are expected to do more. Both sides of politics expect that. And despite all of this neoliberal rhetoric about more efficiency in the public sector and smaller governments, voters are actually asking for better quality services, and consistently in opinion polls, when people are given the choice between lower taxes and higher quality public services, they favour higher quality public services, and that's across all income groups and all sort of demographic groups in society. But also just want to pick up some, I don't want to just pick on Tim, but just pick up on some of Adam's points. Again, you talk about sort of asylum seekers, refugees, and a whole range of other vulnerable groups, but I do note that in your parliamentary agreement with the Labor Party, there was really only one measure in there, a social justice measure, and that was the dental care. So I'm just curious, if you acknowledge all of these problems, and certainly the turning point for the Greens was the 2001 election, where asylum seekers was front and centre in the election campaign, and there was an increase in the Greens' vote, why didn't you drive a harder bargain? And it just seems to me that there's this tension within Green ideology that when it comes to saving a tree, comes to saving a person, the Greens will always go for that tree over that person. Mm. And I mean, with this sort of the climate change policy and the package that you've negotiated, I mean, the biggest impact, I'm not against action on climate change, but the biggest impact proportionally is going to be on lower income earners. And it sometimes seems that the Greens sort of lose sight of that. And, well, and just before you jump in, I'm just also wondering how much longer you're going to run this sort of old party's argument, because the Greens, Australian Greens, are the oldest Green Party in the world, been around since the 70s. I think that's pretty old.
So the, I mean, the climate change package that we've just negotiated had a massive emphasis on low-income earners and ensuring that the money that's raised from making polluters pay for the pollution that up till now we thought was free, but now we know isn't. It's skewed towards going to the lower end, and it's intentional that lower income earners, many of them will come out ahead. And as someone, I've got an electorate that's got more public housing dwellings than anywhere else in the country, and we made sure that all of the money that's received for public housing tenants isn't going to go on rent, because they pay 25% of their income on rent. So we went to some great trouble to ensure that it had a really strong social justice component to it. And look, in terms of why we didn't get further with asylum seekers in our negotiations with Labor, it would probably come as no surprise to know that we've got different positions to them. And we're not in a coalition with Labor. We have supported them in minority government, and we found areas of agreement where we could. Treatment of asylum seekers isn't one of them, because the Labor Party's decided they'd rather be more like the coalition. Not the coalition of Malcolm Fraser era, but the coalition of the John Howard era. That's a matter for them, and it's not for want of trying, but they've decided that's what side their bread's buttered on, and I think it's ultimately going to hurt them.
OK. I want to bring the audience in, because I'm aware that you've been sitting very patiently. Narelle, do you want to...?
No, look, the only thing I was... When everybody was having this discussion, I think people lose sight of the fact that minority governments are actually really good for the country. If for no other reason is that it slows the big parties down. It forces them to take stock. It reminds them that they're not invincible. It reminds them that they probably do need to be engaging with a wider array of ideas and different kinds of constituencies, different types of parties as well. And I think minority governments are never a mistake. I think the public knew that maybe things were reaching a point where it was all becoming a little untenable, and maybe both of the big parties needed to be slowed down somewhat. And if at the end of this everyone decides that it was all a big, gigantic mistake, all we need to do and all the public needs to do is elect one party into government and to give them the power to do the things that they need to do. But at least at this point in time, it's meant that other interests or different types of interests are getting a voice where previously they may not. Now, the outcomes are never going to be perfect, and not everybody is going to get what they want, but that's never the case anyway. But I do think minority governments have just slowed everything down, and I just think that's a good thing.
So do you agree with Adam then that in some cases that slowing down, that involving more people can actually generate, can generate perhaps a different quality of politics, but would you agree with him that it might actually generate a better policy outcome?
Maybe not in every case, and I'm not suggesting that it necessarily means that it will always deliver better policy outcomes, but it may just do that at the same time. I would be reluctant to say that it means that in every case that we're going to get a better policy outcome. but we may get a slightly different policy outcome, and at the very least, different kinds of voices may be represented in those debates. And I think that that has to be better in the long run, at least.
I think one of the other reasons for the rotten policy development over decades now is also because of the kind of people who go into politics. We used to get a much wider variety of people. You know, the Labour Party used to have people who were once shearers. And Liberal Party used to have business people and so on. These days, all the politicians tend to look very much the same, and you get a great many people who've never actually done anything other than build a political career. And that means that they're dependent on the grace and favour of party leaderships and less likely to think independently, even if they're capable of it.
It also means that often they don't actually understand ideas.
Mm.
And I mean it quite seriously. A lot of people in politics that I know from both sides of Parliament, to be quite frank, have spent time with staffers or as union activists, and what they know is how to win. Now, that I'm not saying that's completely contradictory to the idea that of good philosophical principle and the capacity to debate ideas, but more often than not, it seems to come very much at the expense of their preparedness to trade things off. There's nothing wrong with compromise in some cases, but when you basically don't believe in anything, you're prepared to put up any policy to justify winning. And we've seen that in many cases in the past, and we will continue to do so in the future. So I agree with Margaret.
OK, I really want to bring the audience in now because you've been very patient. Gentlemen there. We've got a microphone on its way to you.
Why does the panel think that the Australian media is so uncomfortable with the concept of minority government and even at times presents it as being undemocratic?
Well, I think I'm the representative of the Australian media on the show, aren't I, which is a bit uncomfortable.
Take it on the chin.
I think, again, political reporting has increasingly become a matter of the insiders. I find it enormously ironic that there's a program on the ABC with insiders on it, and all the insiders are journalists. I share Jay Rosen's view on that. He was here in Australia recently. And they don't know how it works. They know how to cover the horse race, which is relatively easy, and they're very comfortable, or have grown very comfortable, with the mechanics of how things have always worked to this point. So minority government is more difficult to cover, more complicated, I suspect. The power relationships work differently, and that makes a journalist's job not necessarily harder, perhaps harder, but different from what it has been. I mean, I've been a critic of the quality of our political reporting for a long while, and I think the fact that anything different is necessarily seen as bad is just an example of that.
Can I suggest three things to you? One is that I think that it's new, it's relatively new, and people haven't known how to respond to it, and I actually think that Tony Windsor said, look, give 2 years into the minority government is the time to judge whether or not it's achieved anything. If after 2 years you haven't been able to achieve anything, then people are right to be able to say it's no good, but give it 2 years because it'll take a little while to get used to it. And then after people get used to it, look at the outcomes and say, has this been good for us? Secondly, I think that in general, the media love conflict and love conflict almost more than anything else. And so whereas in other countries where they have minority governments regularly, the fact that the government wants to do something but can't muster the numbers in the parliament happens on almost a weekly basis and people don't bat an eyelid. Here, if there's one motion that's lost, all of a sudden the government's in crisis, which is just rubbish when you look at the legislation that's been passed, etc. So I think there's an inordinate attention on that. And I guess thirdly, I think Tony Abbott's never given it a chance, and it's been his decision day one to tear the whole thing down. And he's got some pretty willing accomplices in certain sections of the media. They've made it their decision that they're going to do that. And I think they're prosecuting that campaign reasonably well at the moment, if you look at the opinion polls. But again, I would be a bit like with Tony Windsor. Look, once the climate change legislation is through, people realise the sky isn't going to fall in. Then people start receiving their compensation checks, the wind farms start being built and so on. I think give it 12 months' time, we might be looking at a very different set of poll numbers and having a very different conversation.
Yeah, I love the optimism there. I don't think you're going to be proven to be right, Adam, but we'll wait and see. I'm happy to be wrong. Actually, no, I'm unhappy to be wrong, but we'll wait and see. Look, I think it's because it shakes them out of their comfort zone. You know, a lot of journalists are used to very comfortable, straightforward way of reporting the media. Some of them, to be quite frank, can often be lazy and not want to think about things, and this has forced them to think about it, about policy more deeply. And I actually think that overall the amount of analysis by the media of policy has been absolutely abysmal. And I don't mean abysmal, I mean disgraceful. The sort of information and analysis that's been provided in terms of, again, I'll talk about, I won't go into detail about the carbon tax, but about how the carbon tax has been analysed, has just been hopeless. And I'd say that actually from both sides. You know, if I was on the other side of the debate, I'd probably agree broadly with that statement as well. But obviously, if you oppose it as I do so strongly, the analysis has just been pathetic. And, you know, this fits into a broader trend of why isn't there any investigative journalism anymore and everything else. But the way they have covered it, most policy issues to me has just been he said, she said, you know, and it's played the politics rather than the policy dimension. There's actually really a need for some good policy analysts as journalists, in my view, particularly in this current political environment. But in terms of why it's undemocratic, or why they perceive it as undemocratic, obviously you've got the makeup of the parliament, the votes in different seats, obviously the carbon tax and people's attitudes, and also what the government presented to the public has a big impact. But it's not, individual events don't create huge problems for governments and how media perceives things. It's patterns of behaviour, and what we've seen particularly with this government is constant bungles throughout the time, and that's not necessarily the parliament's fault or the parliament has failed, but certainly the government, through a lack of policy development, a lack of moral courage for what they used to believe in anyway, as well as adding over the overlay of the political dynamics, it just feeds into this idea that this government is hopeless and incompetent, and it would be better in some way to go to an election to provide a level of certainty, because as Australians, we're not comfortable with being uncomfortable this way and uncertain this way.
Narelle, did you want to say something?
I think I agree. I think the bias isn't just about, isn't just reflected in what the media does or how it reports on things, but I also think it also reflects in part a general uncomfortableness or discomfort that most Australians feel about minority governments. I'm not, while we were clearly the people responsible for having elected a minority government, I'm never entirely convinced that the public are always prepared for what happens as a consequence of making those kinds of decisions. And the normal pattern is that they'll deliver a minority government and then the next time round they won't do that. They don't normally repeat that practice. So I think that this is just a long-standing bias, and I think that the media are infected by this kind of general sense, and I think so are we as a broader constituency. I think there are clearly some people that don't fall victim to these kind of ideas, but I do think for the most part the public probably struggle as well.
Okay, I have a question here from John on Twitter, who's here tonight, and this speaks to the thread, I think, of the discussion all of the panellists seem to agree that the policy isn't perhaps done as well as it ought to be, and somehow that's got something to do with the quality of politics and the quality of politicians. And John says, refugees are the first to suffer in a minority government. Should this issue be depoliticised? Mm-hmm. Scott?
I think refugees have suffered under the majority government as well. I mean, Howard had control of two houses of parliament, and I don't think there's a qualitative difference in the sort of the policies that are being pursued. What we have to remember is most of the time in this particular area of policy, Liberal and Labor will often agree and will often, pass legislation on their numbers alone. So it kind of really doesn't matter who else is in the parliament, as long as those two biggest groups are in the parliament making policy.
His point is, should the issue be depoliticised? So if you're saying it doesn't matter what the government is, it's always going to be messy and are you agreeing with him that it should be depoliticised?
I don't know how you can depoliticise it. I don't think we should be scared that it is a political issue either. What it would be good, though, is to be hearing some other sorts of viewpoints and some other sorts of policy approaches. And there is a problem when you have the two biggest groups, political groups, essentially advocating the same policy. That's a problem. But I think the bigger problem is in Australia is just tight party discipline. So there is actually disagreement in both of the major parties on this policy, but we just don't hear it in public forums. It's all done in the privacy of a party room. Australia has some of the tightest party discipline in the world, of a liberal democracy, and it's unsurprising. We also have the highest number of independents in the world of any comparable liberal democracy. So something's going on there. And if you look to Britain, if you look to the United States, you will see members of the governing party, of the same party, taking a different position and speaking out and, if necessary, voting against what their party's telling them. So I think that is actually the bigger problem in Australia. And going back to that media question, the media is sort of unsure how to cover that, because if a party, if there is difference of opinion in the party, that's disunity, that's a bad thing. I think, yeah, that's probably a bigger issue. And I think if we had more of diversity of opinion in the major parties, you know, this minority-majority government, a lot of these arguments wouldn't be relevant.
OK, I'm going to take another question from the audience. At the back, lady at the back there.
Hi, I think I'm hearing general consensus that there is a lack of public policy and we're all very distressed about it. The tax on mining profits, I would suggest, is a redistribution of wealth via superannuation and will give about $108,000 to lower income earners over a lifetime. Is this not policy?
Okay, who wants to pick that up? Tim?
Well, you know, how you want to define policy is really up to you. I mean, what I think we've seen in this parliament is an enormous amount of things called reform, which actually aren't reform, which aren't beneficial to the economy and society. And you take the mining tax. Nobody actually really argues against reform of the mining tax system. What we, you know, we get into debate about is how you do it. In fact, it was actually the Minerals Council, I think, who originally flagged the idea of a minerals resource rent tax, but they just obviously wanted a different design. But that presumes, in your question, that you know, constantly designing policies that transfer wealth from one sector of the community to another sector of the community is an entirely desirable policy objective, and I'm not sure I agree with that at all. And particularly in the nature of what has been junked. Again, this isn't related to the minority government, but I think we've seen more of this, is a junking of the entire concept of federalism in our country and competitive governance, which is an absolute disaster for this country and will continue to be a disaster for this country. We might be one nation under a commonwealth, but we are a federation for a reason, and we have states, and they should compete with each other based on their arrangements and their tax codes and everything else. And that is in the interests of consumers. If businesses behaved the way governments did and colluded like they do with COAG, they would be accused of collusion and be smashed by the ACCC. Yet we somehow think that one sense of governance is an entirely desirable policy objective. The states own these resources and states should design policies about how that value to the people who are in those states should be reflected. And we need to see a lot more of that across the entire political system and the policy system, which is to protect your interests and my interests and the interests of the nation.
Adam. I was going to respond to that, but just, I think this idea of competitive federalism, I've got to say, I mean, it's a, in so many ways it's a race to the bottom, and you end up with these absurd situations where one capital city or one state government poaches a manufacturing facility from another state by offering them higher subsidies to operate in less efficient ways. Simply because they can then say, well, we've got this new motor vehicle plant in our backyard, and so come over here. And so, and in effect, what I think it is competitive federalism just results in enormous sums of monies that could be spent on services being redirected to companies in the form of subsidies to entice them across borders for political and electoral reasons.
You should come over outside. We're anti-subsidy.
Yeah, good. but just picking up on this general theme about decline of policy, I guess. There can be this analysis that Lindsay Tanner and others have gone on about whether it's politicians or whether it's the media. It's actually not that hard. Like, think long term, develop some ideas that are based on that and go out and advocate them. And that's something that I think, I'd like to think that I did during the course of the election campaign and the Greens did, and you actually get a good response, because I think the sense that we're getting from this room is actually something that a broad section of the Australian population feels. Why isn't politics about a clash of ideals anymore? Why isn't politics about, if you had to think of a phrase to describe the last election, it wouldn't be two positive visions from about the direction of the country. I mean, you looked at the ads from Labor and Liberal, and it was the same ads, just with different voiceovers, pictures of menacing boats going through seas and stuff. And so I actually think the population, the public, is crying out for it, and I think it's not that hard to do. And I think the mining tax is a classic example of small p politics over good policy. The Treasury aren't a bunch of Marxist radicals. This was Ken Henry in the Treasury saying, this is how we are going to fund the infrastructure and the services that we're going to need in the future by doing this. And then the mining companies came to town and spent $22 or $26 million, nothing to them, and they've changed a prime minister and changed a policy and saved themselves $100 billion over the next decade. And that's money that we're all going to have to find in some other way to fund services. And during the course of my election campaign, that to me was the sleeper issue, the issue that people would come to me and volunteer, not me raising, but volunteer and say, I can't believe the government's just caved in on this mining tax. What a good idea it was. Why aren't we going ahead with it? Astounded me, and I think it reflects that general sense that people want to hear long-term, constructive, positive thinking.
One thing you didn't mention, and I don't mean to be trivial, but I do think it's important. You talked about ideals, you talked about long-term vision, and you talked about consulting with people. But one thing you didn't mention, which as a public policy teacher I talk about all the time, was evidence. And I'm just wondering what one of the things that we deal with all the time is what's the balance between what's always proclaimed as being the holy grail, the evidence-based policy, and then a set of political ideals, which are in themselves important and valuable. What's your take on that?
Well, I think there are some things that don't lend themselves to evidence-based policy. I mean, if you say what's the question about the best way to fund our future services need, I think that's rightly a political discussion. And there are some things that evidence will help and be an input into, but a lot of things it's a question of value and you've got to make the decision on that basis. But that's not to say things shouldn't be tested. And just to come back to this Parliamentary Budget Office point that I said, one of the things that we insisted on in our agreement was the establishment of an independent body, independent of Treasury, that will have the ability to cost parties' policies independently in the lead-up to the election. We actually went to the last election, we wrote to Treasury and said, would you cost our policies? And they said, no, we won't. We will only cost government policies. And we often cop a lot of flack for having uncosted ideas and whatever, and we're screaming out for that to happen. So now we're going to have a body, won't be as big and as powerful as the US budget office, but that is going to be able to independently subject political parties' promises to costings and to testing. And I think that's a good thing. That's a step towards that.
I don't want to sound like I'm sort of breaching this wonderful new consensus between left and right, but I actually agree with almost everything Adam just said. Because I just want to say that I really, I noticed how taught in universities, because I did public policy at university as well. There is no holy grail in public policy. Public policy is about politics, which is about values. And what you decide is both the problem and the solution is impacted based on people's values. And you can find evidence to justify anything in a literal sense, you can. You have to decide what are the challenges and then what the solutions are, and you can always find the evidence to back up your arguments. The idea that there's some wonderful solution that if everybody got together and had some wonderful harmonious discussion, we came up with the perfect public policy outcome is a sham, because often we can't even agree on what the problem is first, let alone, which is why, going back to the point earlier about the Indigenous disadvantage, it's bizarre that we can't get some sort of public policy outcome, because we've actually made the massive first step. If you go and look at climate change, half the problem is we haven't even all agreed on the problem, let alone what the solution is.
Did you want to come in?
No, I mean, I would agree with that. I'm always a bit suspicious of calls for bipartisanship in almost any area of policy. I think it's good to have different ideas competing. But to pick up on the lady's point, I actually think the whole handling of the tax package is an example of poor policy development by politicians. I mean, it was public servant-led policy in the extent that there was a package at all from Ken Henry. He was the thinker and the people around him, not the politicians, and the politicians have largely balls it up, it seems to me, or failed to get to grips with it. That's a problem. Why aren't the two sides of politics tackling our broken tax system? And it is largely broken, I think.
Okay, who would like to ask the next question? I've got a lady down here.
I'd just like to ask in reverse of what Adam's been talking about. When opinion polls are made, it seems to me it's like market research. Nobody ever asks an open-ended question.
to find out what people really think about things.
Can everybody hear that? The question was that when opinion polls are made, nobody ever really asks an open-ended question, so that the questions aren't terribly authentic and helpful in themselves. Is that sure?
They're quantitative rather than qualitative.
Yes, of course. I'll bring Margaret in first on that.
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, and one of the research projects I'm trying to get up at the moment is around an idea that's been kicking around in journalism for a while called the citizen's agenda, which is the idea that in deciding how to cover a political contest, the media should first of all use all of the means at its disposal, including public opinion polls, to ask not who do you want to vote for, but what do you want them to be talking about? What should the agenda be for the election? And then to devote journalistic resources to pursuing that agenda, whether or not the politicians want to talk about it. And so to investigate it, to do independent research, to do policy analysis on it, to keep pitching questions to the politicians on those issues, rather than letting the political apparatchiks set the policy. I think that's a really interesting idea. I think it could transform both the reporting of politics and the politics itself, and is really worth experimentation.
Anybody else want to come in on that?
Yeah, go. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, you go.
Narelle.
Oh, me. Okay. This is really more a question for the audience, I suppose. I'm just wondering to what extent people actually think that the public themselves are quite cynical about policy. I mean, even sometimes when we're offered halfway decent policy ideas, you kind of get a sense nowadays that nothing maybe always satisfies the public in the way that it might have done 40, 50 years ago, and I'm wondering to what extent that reflects the fact that some people are much more educated than they've been before, that they maybe think about these things, think about these policy issues a bit differently than what they might have done 50 to 60 years ago. I'm just wondering whether or not we can satisfy the public, particularly if the public is a fairly fragmented looking constituency, and probably more fragmented than it ever has been at any other point in history.
Okay, would anybody from the audience like to respond to that? Since we're turning this whole thing around.
Sorry, I didn't mean to turn it around. I was just thinking.
Would you like to respond to that, sir? Yeah, just down here.
I think the major problem with policy and with this discussion is that it just keeps circling around the cause of all the problems, and the cause is the corporation. And I'm wondering if you all signed a self-censoring contract before you came up on stage which said, we're not allowed to mention the corporation. That's what perverts the polity. That's what perverts the media. The media are a corporation. So if you want to get a good policy in, you got to run it by the corporate sector, which Tim works for, and they're going to say no, because that serves the public, and we're only interested in our narrow concentrations of power. That's what the corporation does. That's what the corporation is doing to us. Now, I don't see why in an academic forum, when we've got a Greens member here, we're not allowed to name and criticise the perverse effect that the corporation has on policy in this country.
Okay. Anybody like to pick that up?
Oh, look, I don't know if I put it exactly the same way, but I agree with the sentiment. And I don't think, when it comes to the media, we in the Greens have been backwards in coming forward about criticising certain corporations that own an enormous amount of the media in this country, and we've copped a lot of stick for it, and they run editorials saying we should be destroyed at the ballot box as a result of it. Look, I think it is significant, and I think that I think there's been a significant political shift in the last 30, 40 years where the Labor Party decided that on key economic and social questions, it was going to move to the right and sing from the same song sheet as the Conservatives, which was basically the neoliberal song sheet. And I think there's a lot of people who see that as quite a limited approach that doesn't work in the interest of people. And to come back to the point about the opinion polls, I do a fair bit of door knocking in this role, and we did during the campaign, and I often take teams of people out who've never door knocked before, and they're usually terrified about what's going to happen when you knock on someone's door and have a chat with them. And we always, after getting over the formalities, go to an open question. What do you think should be the priorities in Canberra? What do you think people should be talking about? And every time at the end of the door knocking session, people come back and say, that was amazing. First of all, people get a bit shocked that someone's coming to their door saying, tell me what you think. What do you think is important? but people want to talk about it. Like, the appetite for discussion is there. There's just not the forum or the means to do it in quite the same way anymore, but I think the appetite's there.
I just want to comment on that. I mean, corporate interests play a role in public policy debate, and I think there should be criticism of corporations. I mean, I've been very critical of rent-seeking companies who seek to profit out of the green energy fund that Adam has been putting up on billboards around town, because it's basically a form of rent-seeking. And I'm against corporate welfare of all types, whether it's for brown or green industries. I sort of take your point, but they're entirely open to criticism. The question is whether the criticism is valid or what the contribution is. I mean, just saying, well, they're setting up for their best interest. Well, yeah, all right, fine. So do a lot of voters. It's actually about people being able to analyse it and critique it and what the basis is, and also to value it then against what the broader values are. Sometimes corporations stand up and advocate for a cause which happens to also ally with people's values. That's, you know, not criminal in any way or necessarily wrong.
Scott, do you want to chip in?
Yeah, there's quite a few different issues going on, so just maybe go back a few steps to your evidence-based policy, put it on policy terms. I mean, there is evidence-based policy in Australia. It's what do the focus groups in marginal seats say? That's the evidence that political parties are using. And what I really loved about this election result is while the major parties were out there in Western Sydney and Queensland campaigning feverishly, in the aftermath, it was Melbourne, it was Hobart, it was regional New South Wales that decided the outcome. And so I don't think the problem is that the public isn't being consulted. It's just it's a very narrow section of the public that's being consulted. And the way that our political system or electoral system works, it's the all-important marginal seats that ultimately get heard and get heard the loudest. So what I'd like to see is some more voices from different parts of Australia also being heard. And I think that's what this parliament's a minority government, that gives us the opportunity to do.
Okay. I'm conscious of time and we need to bring this to a close, so I just want to ask all of the panellists one final question, and it's back to the Queen. I'm British, I can't help myself. Apparently the Queen has commented on the difficulties of minority government since she's been here in private. What I want to ask each of you is, if you were the Queen, what advice would you be giving to Prime Minister Julia Gillard? Margaret, can I start with you?
Oh, my gosh. if I was the Queen. I don't think the Queen should be giving any advice to our Prime Minister at all, really.
That's a politician's answer, Margaret.
No, I mean, I really can't see what she could possibly say. I imagine the Queen's got some observations on how women can be popular. but really, I think it would be very inappropriate for the Queen to be giving much advice at all, really.
Okay. Narelle.
I think probably just to hold a nerve at this point, because I think she's had a pretty bumpy road, and I realise that some of the difficulties are self-induced, that there's been some failures on the part of this government to sell what it's doing and why it's doing the things that it's done. But I think the worst thing this government could do is to change its leader. I think that it just pretty much needs to sit on its hands, actually, and do little and make itself as small a target as possible, which is probably not the kind of thing that I probably should be advocating. But you don't get yourself into as much trouble if you're not doing a great deal, you know? It's been my experience anyway. Yeah.
I guess the cynic in me, so maybe not the Queen, I probably think or say, democracy is a bitch. It's better to be born into privilege and a powerful position than to be.
Good answer. Tim, follow that.
I'm going to actually make a point and be dry. My answer would be respect the Constitution and fix our federalism, because the system we've inherited is there for a reason. I'm not saying our federation isn't perfect, and there are a lot of problems, but our political system is designed to avoid many of the conflicts that come out of our current political system. And, you know, you just need to look at this room. Adam represents the electorate of Melbourne. He broadly represents the values and the views in that electorate. And I don't really dispute that, even though I disagree with many of them. And when you chuck him in a room with a whole bunch of other people who have radically different cultures and views, you get different outcomes, and our federalist system is designed to address the fact that decisions and policies and laws that govern people are best designed closest to those who affect them. And that would be my recommendation.
Okay. Adam.
As someone who is regularly meeting with the Prime Minister, I don't think I can imagine myself as the Queen doing that. But I think my advice would be sort of similar to that Narelle said. I think that it's to stay the course, because, and I actually think that it would be very difficult for it would have been very difficult for anyone other than Julia Gillard to have negotiated what was needed to form the minority government. And I think she's actually quite disagree with her on a range of things, but she's quite good at it, and you know where you stand in discussions with her. And I think that there is a role for leaders in this country that are leaders because they are good at getting a variety of different points of view in a space and getting an outcome from it. And I think that if we can, and I see no reason why the Parliament won't last its full term, and I really do think that there's every chance that despite it now, that people will look back on it at the end and say, actually, that was good having those different voices at the table. We got some good things done.
OK, well, I'm going to draw it to a close at that point. I think we've had an unexpected outbreak of consensus and certainly an awful lot of thought, food for thought for people in academia about the quality of policymaking and how we might go about making that better. So we need to fix that as well as fixing some of the political difficulties. But at this point, I would just like to thank all of the panellists for giving up the time for attending and for giving us a lively, if somewhat unexpected, debate in parts. To thank you for attending, and also to remind you that there is a reception upstairs in the Arts Hall, which is a great opportunity to continue this discussion. If people don't know where that is, there are people who are available to help you find your way. So please do join us straight after this. Thank you all very much indeed.